Well, my name is Naomi Miyake from Tokyo University, Japan. Jefferson, thank you very much for the nice introduction, and for the audience, thank you very much for staying to the very last talk. I think after that gigantic view and requirements for what quantum scientists should be doing to prepare for the space age, I'm going to bring you back to some of the very basics of cognitive science, if you let me. I've titled my talk as Externalized Cognitive Processes for, and skipped from the print in proceedings, but the collaborative knowledge construction. This is in most of the work that I'm going to talk about has been done in a collaboration with particularly Hajime Shirazu and the other members from my laboratory. Let me end a little bit of my self-introduction. I spent 1977 to 82 at the University of California, San Diego. That was the time that the cognitive science took off ground in the United States, and I just witnessed the birth of cognitive science in the United States. And my dissertation work focused on constructive interaction, which was published in Cognitive Science in 1986. And somehow after that, there has been, I think it was a kind of the trend of the time, but more interest has been put on interactive aspect of human cognitive workings. And currently, I'm teaching at the Japanese only one school of computer and cognitive sciences. Well, a department which has the name cognitive science on it is only one in Japan under the Tokyo University since 1991. It's about 10 years. And I have been doing mostly the work in the basic area, research area, to understand the interaction of internal, which is a knowledge inside of your head, and external, what you would be having outside of physical world resources, and particularly trying to tie that basic research to apply for our human welfare to raise probably our intelligence as well as the system's intelligence and so on. So the cognitive science for me has been a study of cognitive processes in the real world, and I take the aspects of real world as external resources, or particularly having other people around. And also my belief of the interest of cognitive science research comes from that we always kind of take a very pragmatic view, that we want to see the findings of our basic research applicable to the real life. So the research would not end but with just giving a formula to understand or the model some situation. But I think as a cognitive scientist, basically our hope is to try to take that implication and see whether we can make some change in the world. And from that, with that sort of philosophy, there are lots of things sort of happening around the field of cognitive science, and I'm particularly paying close attention to a new emergence of science called the learning sciences, where people are trying to take cognitive science very seriously and are trying to create our social environment learnable for us as well as for the people who follow us. So in that sense, my research sort of spans a rather broad scope and taking developing learning environments rather seriously. And at the same time, to make that work better, I'm doing more fundamental work to support this effort on which I'm going to focus most of my talk today. So let me talk about how I see the internal-external interaction, which is how we do any kind of problem solving or the decision making or even the perception or the use of language, etc., in the world, while sort of mobilely keeping whatever we have inside of our head and making changes in the outside world and taking advantage of that change that we make or the others make to the external world. To illustrate this kind of work, I'm going to focus my talk on a particular task, which is, suppose that you are given a square sheet of paper, or smaller than that, foldable, and a pencil, and asked, please indicate 2/3 of 3/4 of this origami paper by whatever the way, and the shading with an oblique line, for example. Please take a moment and think. Because you don't have those external world, and I'm saying that the external world is very important for your achieving those tasks. This is a silly question to ask, but just imagine what you would be doing. How many of you think that you would start either folding or drawing, checking marks on the paper, or cutting or whatever, but try to solve this problem with the external resource that you have, which is the paper? How many of you think you would be doing that? Okay, thank you. And with this kind of a scientific audience, and I imagine that some of the people while I was talking tried to solve this problem in a very symbolic way, which is by probably doing this fractional multiplication. How many of you did this and got the answer is 1/2? The other people are trying to decide which way I'm going. Okay. We have been doing very many different conditions and running this experiment with probably more than 300 people by now. I don't know whether to some surprise of yours, about 90% of people in very many different conditions just go to use the external resources. So what would you expect, for example, like would question differences like 2/3 of 3/4 be different from 3/4 of 2/3? By the way, this should come to the same answer, just to make sure. And for the Japanese audience, the order in Japanese comes in a different way. 2/3 of 3/4 comes 4/3 of 3/4. So after the orders may have something to do, but how many of you think that this would cause some difference or the different pattern? So some at least expect that. Nope. These are the proportional data. And you may have some difficulty seeing the small lines, but this is the 2/3 first. It's a proportional bar, and the whiter part is the people, or the proportion of people who use external worlds. So everybody in this condition tested on 3/4 of 2/3, either folded or put marks on the paper. And only one person out of the 20 didn't do anything on the paper. And when she took the pencil, she just straightforwardly went to draw the line on the origami and shaded. So you may be starting to worry about the foldability of the origami paper or the Japanese culture of folding papers to make things or whatever the thing that you have in your head. So what if not, thank you, what if this experiment was done not just with an origami paper but thick construction paper or even an acrylic board? Any guess? Again, almost no difference in response patterns. People still keep, well, of course, they don't try to fold this. They just try to start marking things, but still try to use external words extensively to solve this problem. So there has been a lot of talk that outside of the world sort of affords us to let us do some kind of, some pattern of cognitive workings. But here we are seeing some small evidence talking against that. Human beings seem to be a lot more, in a sense, active to start working on the external worlds and to make use of them rather than responding to the foldability or the unfoldability to the materials given to you. Other manipulations? We did lots of other things, but I just brought three here. You may be starting to worry whether the Japanese, well, all these was all these were all done on Japanese college students, and whether those students could ever calculate those, could do those fractional multiplications. So we asked for one group of students to do those with a pencil and paper on the written test form on the backside of the origami prior to this task. So they did about 10 of those practices, which included the 2/3 multiplied by 3/4 and 3/4 multiplied by 2/3. And after collecting those papers, immediately after that, and we asked the same question, and well, lo and behold, the ratio of the people who started to calculate got a little bit higher, but still, the majority tried to use the external worlds. Was the auditory instruction having some effect? We showed them the instruction in the visual form. Didn't work very well. We told them not just the 2/3 of 3/4, but shade me the area of 2/3 multiplied by 3/4. There are still about 50% of the people who try to use the external world. So we went one step farther and started to collect some systematic data on this kind of sequential trials. First, we asked either the 2/3 of 3/4 or the 3/4 of the 2/3, and then immediately after that, we asked them to do the reversed question. So in this case, a subject who answered 2/3 of 3/4 turned in the paper, and in fact he was asked what was the answer at this point. And then he was given a next sheet and asked a different question, this time 3/4 of 2/3. In this condition, we saw small proportion of people started to shift the strategy. But the proportion is not very big. Probably a lot smaller than you expected to see. This was a lot smaller than we expected to see. So this really got us into the process analysis to try to sort out what is really happening in this. And one thing that we worried is whether the answer to the first trial, which is materialized on the external world, right in front of the eyes of the subject, what kind of effect does that answer have? Or what do subjects see in their answers to the first question? Taking those 20 subjects who did the 2/3 first and 3/4 next and the 3/4 first and 2/3 next, out of the 40 answers, and this is the tabulation of the analyzable patterns of those data, and for those who didn't use arithmetic, did not give any verbal answer, tend not to give any verbal answer to the question. We did get about 1/3 of people who kind of stopped and said, answer. Looks like it's a half or it's 1/2. But there are a lot more common pattern was this. And those, what do those people do? They just repeated the instruction, answer, 2/3 of 3/4. Or just show the area with a hand or indicated with a pointer to the area. Or just smiled. But compared to that, the people that solved the problem in an arithmetic way, about 80% of the people explicitly mentioned that's 1/2. You might start worrying about what's really happening. I haven't been showing you any externalized traces of the things that could happen. This is the 2/3 of 3/4 case. But if you go in a fleeting way, the resulting area is this, which looks very much like 1/2. But if you go taking two thirds and sort of diagonally taking three fourths, the resultant area is this, which does not necessarily or readily appear to be one half. Well, if you know the answer, so it may be a little bit difficult to persuade you, but that there is some appearance differences, and that appearance differences may seem to have certain effects, like these are the clear appearance conditions, and these are the unclear appearances, and whether the subject answered verbally to the one-halfness to our question of what was the answer, we could see that clear appearance at least had some effect. When the answer or the externalized answer was unclear, nobody mentioned that. But the more interesting question is, how many of amongst of those changed, and particularly how many of these people who verbalized the one-halfness used that in the consecutive task? The proportion is still very small. Some of the people, just four out of these five, mentioned that the what is out there appears as the half or the one half, but still did not try to change the way to solve the problem. We also did a video analysis of how those people folded the papers, and this is just a one portion of that analysis showing what would happen if a person is taking the three quarters or the two thirds, folding the three first. This would be the most economic way to fold it into three and directly go down to folding it into four. But those red arrows, thick ones, show what people preferred, and you only see nobody from here came down here. So what really happened, many of the people, or at least for this analysis, almost everybody took this course, which included an intermediate extra stop of opening the paper, which is really an extra step, because what you want to do is getting the three-fourths of two-thirds. We interpret this as a step which allows the subject to confirm what they are making out there is really two-thirds. So when they create something on a sheet of paper, which is put in front of them and asked what the answer was, they do not necessarily go and see what's out there. But when they are trying to solve the problem, when they are in the midst of these cognitive workings, they seem to go take this extra step to confirm what they are doing. Combined the old findings so far, that we can tentatively say, I think, that the subjects seem to have their own way to solve the problem and rather strongly pursue it and try to do whatever they can do with the external world to take advantage of that world, like making some trades and opening it and confirm that what they are doing is correct. And they are, in any sense, a passive responders to outside appearances. So what else could we say out of this? Let's go back to some part of the data. The who really shifted anyway? There are those two who are actually, because of the demand of the experiment, there was a prompt from the experiment. So here we see a social factor working to do something with this process. To make things clearer, we ran different sets of conditions of the experiment where we used two people to solve this simple problem. Our sort of a concern or the hypothesis is whether the externalization of those intermediate results of their cognitive workings could make the solving processes shareable among those two subjects and would buy them something by it. So in general, what we did was using those consecutive tasks of asking these two slightly different but the same questions in successive order and run subject and compare the paired subjects' performances to the solos. This is the same graph that I showed you before coming from those solo conditions. Again, I just want to remind you that when they're doing this alone, not very many individuals shifted their strategies. But with pairs, we saw over 70% of the people changed what they do on the second task. Not very much difference with individuals on the first trial, but a big difference on the second one. So the interaction that took place while those subjects are doing the first task could have had something to do with this pattern. So what were the pairs doing? Again, taking the similar numbers, among the pairs who had clear appearance answers to the first one, tended to mention that, but we see a similar pattern, and if the answer was not clear, even they were paired, they did not necessarily talk about it. But who shifted? This is a very different part from the single, the solo condition. The pairs who mentioned tended to shift. Well, for this case, we have a 100% shift in those. So this is a part of the protocol. I'm not going to go too much detail for these, but this is kind of a typical, or the most typical case of the protocol. So let me just read it through very quickly. A1 might say, well, here is the 3-4, showing that the 3-4 that he is folding. And A2 might say, we can pick out this area, can't we? Which doesn't communicate to A1. So folding this area into thirds as futon, we sort of, in our culture, put those sleeping mats into the three, then and try to go with it. And A1 says, ha, you seem to have a different image than I, sort of noticing some discrepancy, and hands the paper towards A2 and says, you try it. And A2 starts doing whatever his own way of solving onto them, like folding it this way and making it a three folding. We can get 2/3 of 3/4. So what he's trying to do is to get in the 3/4 and folding it into three and getting the 2/3. By seeing it, A1 says, wait, wait, and showing the middle line, which is the one half line, says, this line is the 3/4, tracing the line with a finger. A2 says, aha, but A1 just continues and says, so folding this area as futon, we can get a 1/3, you see? It gets down to here. And A2 follows that and says, oh, 3/4, aha, 2/3 of 3/4 is. So of 3/4, the 2/3 are here. And A1 notices by getting exposed to what A2 was trying to make out of that and says, oh, silly. And A2 follows, oh, silly. And A1 sort of verbalizes the silliness or the otherness, saying, this is the half. First, where are the 1/3? And which gets followed by A1 saying, yes, here is. These are the 3/4. And A2 says, yes, they are. They are the 3/4, then the 2/3, then the 2/3 of this is where it is. There is a very rapid exchange of confirmation of what's happening over there. And says, A1 says, ah, it's here. They are now pointing down the final answer area. And says, A2 says, it's almost a trick. A1 says, oh, I got it. We could have solved it with multiplication. So the thing, it could have been a little bit difficult for you because I didn't have the visual for you. But the thing I wanted to share with you is the length or the meticulous exchange of the area's interpretation of each person getting sort of gradually shifting from the very much the verbal description of what's out there to the multiplication, which is nowhere out there. So if we take this as those, we can tentatively assume that there could be involved some four steps of doing things. If you are seeing this as a two-step solution problem, whether you have the two-thirds area, the three-quarters, you just have to try to fold it again. So where there these, just noticing there are still two steps, understanding gets verbalized in the utterance, like, now let's get three-fourths out of this two of two-thirds and so on. But in fact, as it was being said, if you take a careful look again on the thing, that because of the origami creases, very often the answer is already out there. So there is just a one-step solution can be noticed, which can be marked by utterances like folding two of two-thirds into four gives us four-sixths. Well, this part does not necessarily get very much verbalized. But after seeing this, the subject, some of the subject could go up and start saying, well, if this is the answer, taking two, taking three out of these four, that makes a 3/6, which is equal to 1/2. And after that realization, as you saw in the previous protocol, the subject could start to talk about the possibility of multiplication. This is what we try to sort of depict, the gradual shift of the levels of their awareness, to very much sort of tie down on what you have exactly in the external world, to bringing up the level, to bring this up to arithmetic abstraction. This is not the only one case observation, and I can show you some patterns of these. And in fact, about 70% of the case of the videos that we analyze, that the people take, there may be just one little jump and so on, but this gradual shift rather than random taking of those four possible occurrences. So summarizing the, our findings as a hypothesis up to here, that I might propose to say that the people use external resources very actively, and the externalized trace of such activity is in principle interpretable in multiple ways. But this multiplicity is not easily available to the owner of the process, or because of his activeness that we hypothesize. But in a collaborative situation, while one is an active task doer, the other can take the monitoring role, who has a better chance to pick out the next step. And this iterates until they come to certain stable point. So does this kind of analysis or the research have any practical value? What we are trying to do is to create some learning environments for, it can be for general, but particularly for the kind of the work that we do for our department, for tentatively the undergraduate cognitive science students, by encouraging and supporting those externalization of those record keeping of their own cognitive workings, and by enhancing collaborative reflection on those external traces. In this way, I think what I'm trying to do is to bridge those basic research and application to see, to start understanding the cognitive workings of human beings and take out those implications to make some change in the real world, to make it better for us, to make us better for the other people and so on. And I can kind of push myself to say that knowing what it means to collaborate is important to design, say, a collaborative learning environment, because to start with, as you have seen, well, it seems to be happening very rapidly and naturally, but the collaboration is a laborious process, because if you don't have to collaborate, you can just say that whatever you got as an answer is the answer, that you can end your job there. But once you start collaborating, there could happen a lot of laborious, extraneous processes in addition to your very simple problem-solving activity. And to be able to do that, as we have seen, those participants in those collaborative situations should be prepared with some initial or own way of solving a problem or the hypothesis to start working with. And because this is a sort of a mentally costly and a laborious process, we need some motivation for change. I would suggest that in collaboration, and particularly putting learners in collaborative situations, we are asking them to change whatever they thought they understood or whatever the problem they thought they had solved, and we are trying to push them to change or broaden or abstract what they had experienced in these situations. So in addition to those very minute process analysis, we study about verbalization, for example, and see how verbalization affects abstraction of procedural knowledge. Or we can even use a very simple classical puzzle in cognitive studies, like Tower of Hanoi, and compare those subjects to who practice the Tower of Hanoi in a very heavily thinking aloud condition against those subjects who were asked not to speak at all. And we start to see those verbalization and how it helps those abstraction of procedural knowledge and so on. And integrating those basic researches, and we are trying to create some support system for the small group discussion for learning. Or putting some emphasis on what kind of record keeping we can use, particularly with some help from technology. And some simple, this is a kind of an old system created by one of our students. But instead of just making students read through the paragraph, we just print each sentence of the paragraph from that paragraph and make a stack of cards and have readers display whatever, they'll put those sentences, whatever, as they go through reading. And this is a simple way, but we can start seeing the reading process probably for the first time for the students who are doing that. And when we put this kind of thing in a collaborative situation, they can start talking about, not about the outcome of what they've read, but how they read, what they are reading, and so on. So we have been experimenting many different ways of externalizing these processes and trying to tie those findings into how to support reading and writing and other semantic integration processes. One of the things that we have been noticing as teaching those courses is that until now, it's a kind of a funny thing once we realize that, but when I start a course of about a semester, what we do is to pick up the research pieces to introduce to the students, and we do a very meticulous job of structuring and integrating those research pieces, which should have been the work of the students. And very often we see that the students are just taking those structure as a very passive way, and one thing or the three research comes each week. And it's a sequential thing once presented to the students, but they have to start doing some semantic integration process. This is a very difficult task, and we do believe that the students need some strong support based on our understandings of how we can do these things. And if the students can start collaborating and talking about their own process of going through these integration processes, that should lead them to be a better integrator. And in general, we have also been testing several different technology available today to create a better learning environment for them. and particularly how we make those documentation systems so that they can start keeping good records of their own learning and become better learners. This is very simple. There are some of the old demonstrations of the system we created and having studied for 3-5 years by now, and this is, as it appears to you, a very simple note sharing system. But the only special feature for this that I might point out is that if you bring up some piece of information here, and bring up some another piece of information here, and if you want to make a connection between these two, you can go up to that button and explicitly write keep records of what kind of linkage you made from this one to that one and this one to that one, which appears as those link lists down here. So when the person, different person or the same person comes back to the same sheet, she starts seeing what kind of relations are made on those. So this is a slightly different way of sharing notes with slight more emphasis on record keeping and so on. So I'd like to suggest that these are the very sort of a subtle way, but try to use what we have been getting to understand how people learn, how people collaborate, and how people create their knowledge, and use those things in their everyday life things. So this just concludes my talk, and I just want to conclude this presentation by saying that we are taking cognitive science seriously and trying to bring those cognitive science findings into the real world to change it. And I do appreciate your listening to the end of this talk. Thank you very much.